Well, now, last night, I was being specific about one of the yogas of everyday life and applying it to the art of cooking. And as a concluding session, I want to discuss the way in which consciousness of your essential oneness with this whole universe and what we call everyday consciousness go together. If you read a great deal about mysticism, you will find descriptions of ecstasies developed through the practice of yoga, meditation, or whatever, that seem to be so completely absorbing, enthralling, ecstatic, and rapturous that you cannot conceive that anybody could be in that state of consciousness and at the same time carry on everyday life. And we hear of great Hindu mystics like Sri Ramakrishna, Sri Ramana Maharshi, who spend hours and hours in samadhi. They sit there with their eyes closed in sheer rapture, out of this world altogether. And if that is the ideal state to which man should attain, that kind of contemplation, obviously, it is inconsistent with everyday life. But there is a strong tradition, not only in India, but also in the Far East, that there is a higher state than samadhi, than rapture. And this much higher state is called in India sahaja, S-A-H-A-J-A, and that means the natural state. The state in which illumination is quite natural and fits in precisely with everything in the way of ordinary consciousness. This is very much a strong feature also of the Zen Buddhist tradition, where they have the saying, your ordinary mind is Buddha, or is the Tao, the way. And in Zen, the poet Hokoji has said, supernatural power and marvelous activity. I draw water, I gather fuel. So that for Zen, there is no distinction whatsoever between what we would call the normal consciousness of the everyday world through our five senses and the supreme state of consciousness of total awakening and enlightenment. Indeed, going back to the fundamental logic of the Upanishads, the great texts upon which all Indian wisdom is based, they insist again and again that the supreme state is without duality. And without duality means without exclusiveness. They would say, for example, that to experience the highest state of consciousness is not merely to experience the oneness of things. You would think, you see, if you experienced all things as one, that somehow the differentiations which you perceive in the world outside you would disappear, and that you would experience all around you in every direction a uniform luminosity in which all differentiation was dissolved. And I can assure you that would be an extremely boring state of mind to get stuck in indefinitely. That's not what to expect. Because the non-dual means the non-exclusive, that which does not have any opposite. And if the ultimate reality behind this universe, the fundamental energy or essence or whatever you want to call it, has no opposite, it is therefore not incompatible with all other states and manifestations of life. So you could say the supreme consciousness is much like a mirror, because a mirror is always clear and pure, and yet it will reflect anything in front of it. There is no incompatibility between the silver purity of the mirror and reflecting the face of a lovely girl or a dirty old ashtray. It will take in both and still remain pure. So in a rather similar way, the enlightened state of consciousness can contain any subordinate state of consciousness. So first of all, I must give some attempt to describe what the awakened state of consciousness is like. And this, naturally, is a very difficult thing to do, because it is, in a way, like trying to describe color to someone who is congenitally blind. And you have to do that by analogy. You can tell a blind person that color is an experience of a certain kind of variations in the world that could be likened to the variations of temperature. We speak about hot colors and cold colors. We call red a hot color and blue a cold color. And that there are vibrations, in a sense, that he knows nothing about, these variations, and they are characteristic of all sorts of things. But he must not confuse what we call color with what he experiences as hot and cold. It's only like it. It's a little bit like that, you see, to have to describe a novel state of consciousness. And in a way, it's more difficult than that, for the simple reason that the consciousness of the total unity or non-duality of the universe is not really like having acquired an additional sense, because it comes through all one's senses. It is very much like a sensation. It's more like a sensation than it is like anything else. It's more like a sensation than it's like an idea, because it's very concrete, very unmistakable the moment you slip into it. And I don't doubt that there are a number of people in this room who have at one time or another slipped into it. It happens quite commonly in adolescence, and again in the dangerous 40s, people are liable to have spontaneous mystical experiences, and sometimes in childhood. Others of you may have come into this by a discipline or by LSD or something of that kind, and so you'll know what I'm talking about. Although you must not, if you experiment with these things, you must not confuse what I would call visionary states with the state of enlightenment. They're quite different. Visionary states are when you experience overwhelming light or see great mandalas and sort of have visions of the cosmos in total harmony. They're not quite at the state of what Buddhists call satori, because there's nothing about it which is, so to say, visionary. It doesn't consist in seeing any particular forms or visions that you can specify. Satori, which is the Zen word in Japanese for awakening, is just exactly like what you're feeling now, except that, as Suzuki once put it, it's about 2 inches off the ground. That is to say, you feel that the same old world that you see outside you is not outside you, but is you. In other words, the trees waving across the swimming pool, and the flowers blooming red, the sunlight playing on the water, the people sitting in the room, and all that, you know that that's just as much you as your own body. and you don't therefore defend yourself against it, you don't resist it. It's all you. And you are therefore doing all those things out there, only you're not doing it as we say we do voluntary acts, but we're doing it in the same way that we grow our hair, or breathe, or beat our hearts. And so you feel all this as the functioning of your own self. Simply that the whole of experience is one single process, unified process, and there is no differentiation between the experiences going on and the one who experiences them. You are what you are experiencing. That becomes absolutely clear. And this, as I say, it reduces the resistance factor that ordinarily exists between the experiencer and the experience, the feeler and the feeling, the thinker and the thought. That disappears. You are no longer standing back and looking at a panorama of events going on as if you were outside it. You know, for example, that what you see outside and in front of you is actually located inside your head. The optic nerves are in the back of the head. And so all the colors and all the shapes that you are aware of with your eyes are in here. They're you. Because you know the external world only by translating yourself into it. Or translating it into yourself. There's no other way of knowing it. It has to become you for you to know it. And when you follow that out, you find out that, of course, the external world exists in relation to you, and you exist in relation to it, in the same sort of way that a back is related to a front. They're inseparable. And without one, you don't have the other. I don't care which one you take away the external world, the individual vanishes, take away the individual, and the external world vanishes. There must, in other words, be some individual, some living being around, for there to be an external world at all. Just as if you slap a drum which has no skin, it makes no noise. Because noise is the relationship between the hand and the drum skin. And the hand can hit as hard can be, and there will be no sound. And if the drum skin doesn't have anything to hit it, it still won't make a noise. You have to have both. And so all over this universe, the universe is called into being by individuals in it. It does not exist except in relationship to perceiving individuals. Because everything that exists is relational. You can only establish movement, that is energy, if there is a relationship between a body in motion and a body at rest. That's what the whole thing is. The whole thing is relationship. Relationship is existence. And relationship between the knower and the known, the still and the moving, is a polar relationship. Polarity means that the opposites, whether we call them to be and not to be, or alive and dead, or light and dark, or north and south, opposites always imply a unity between them, just as the magnet is the solid unity that lies between north and south poles, just as the coin is the unity between heads and tails, just as a sheet of paper is the unity between back and front. So in the same way, there is a unity of the organism and the environment, the knower and the known, and without this polarizing unity, there is nothing happening, nothing doing. So this is what you become aware of. You see absolutely vividly that the differentiations that you notice between solids and spaces, between different spectra of color, between form, between figure and ground, all these differentiations you are normally aware of you experience as not separating things, but rather joining them. The differences show the unity. And therefore, don't expect in the state of Satori everything to dissolve into uniform light or something like that. They stay just as they are. But you hear and see everything in a state of go-withness, where every inside goes with its outside, where every I goes with every thou, where you see that at this moment, everything that comes to you is your own doing, or as Hindus would say, your own karma, your own doing. That doesn't mean your fate, as if someone else was putting it over on you. It doesn't mean your reward or your punishment. It simply means your own doing. Because you feel this different sense of you, what you are, than the ordinary limited ego sense, in which you feel that you're a separate part of the world, accepting or rejecting things that are going on elsewhere. You are doing it all. Only be very careful at this point that you don't get into the state which Jung called inflation. It's very easy for a Westerner to get into an inflated state about this because of our conception of God as the governor of the universe, the political governor of the universe, the supreme monarch. And then as a result of that, if an individual feels that he is really doing the whole thing and is therefore one with God, he's apt to give himself airs and graces and to feel that he is really personally in charge of everything that's going on. And people who get that kind of sensation and interpret it in that way are rather unacceptable socially. And we usually regard them as crazy. Well, that's because they make a god of their ego instead of an ego of their god. They identify the limited ego with the whole universe in such a way as to say, I could change it if I wanted to. I could, on the prompting of an egocentric whim, show off in some way or other by turning the water in the swimming pool into champagne. But when you have the Hindu idea of God, you simply say, naturally one doesn't turn the water into champagne, because it is the will of God that it be water. And you feel that the center of yourself is no longer in this superficial wishing faculty that we call the will, although it's still you. You discover that you run a great deal deeper than your own will, your conscious will. You have, of course, an unconscious will. We know that fundamentally from all that we've done in the West in psychotherapy. We talk about people's unconscious wishes, unconscious drives. And of course all that exists, and that is you at a deeper level than you normally know. So what has happened in this process is that you have discovered, you have centered yourself at your own deepest level. Instead of centering yourself, as it were, somewhere out on the circumference of a wheel, you found your center at the hub. And you have therefore to find the hub of your own organism. Where do you tick from? Well, from the hub. But the hub is not ordinarily the conscious center from which you operate. But as you see, you try the experiments I've been discussing, as you try trusting your own brain to decide what to do, as you try trusting your own nature and following your own natural grain, shall I call it that, you will very soon come to act from your deepest center. And you will at first get the impression that what goes on is puts you in a passive position. You seem at first to get the idea that you are relaxing to a current, to a life motion above and beyond yourself, or deeper than yourself, whichever analogy you want to use. Sometimes we say that that great thoughts are lofty. Sometimes we say they're profound. These are two opposite metaphors. But whether you want to call it high or deep, it doesn't matter. The point is, you feel at first that you are responding to something in you but other than you, a beyond within. But later on, you discover that this isn't other, it's simply you at its deepest level. And you don't feel exactly passive about it. That's what you feel at first, as if you were being carried by a great stream, as if you were responding to a current of air like a leaf. But later on, that duality between the source and the one who responds disappears, and it all becomes a single activity. And the fascinating thing about it is that you realize there is no way of doing it any other way. You can be under the illusion that you are opposing this energy, which we'll call, if you say the Chinese name, the Tao, the course of nature. You can be under the illusion that you're acting against it, that by your egocentricity you somehow create waves in the thing that shouldn't be there. But you can't. There is absolutely no way of going against the Tao. You can imagine that you are against it, because the Tao is complex enough that within its possibilities it includes imagining that you're going against it. That's all part of the game. But actually, you can't. There is no state of mind you can get into. There is no kind of consciousness, no kind of emotion whatsoever that will actually go against it. Now, that's the important thing to understand. As you come to the point of realizing that there's just no way out of this Satori, then you understand it. Because you don't look upon it then as something you can get. That is to say, as some particular state of mind, happy mood, peaceful mood, as distinct from sad mood, depressed mood, or anything. It isn't some particular state of mind that you can acquire and make the object of an ambition. To the degree that you are ambitious to change your state of consciousness, by any means whatsoever, whether it's yoga, whether it's drugs, whether it's, I don't care what it is, prayers, anything. So long as you're ambitious for another state of consciousness than the one you have now, you can't get this thing. Because you can't get it. Buddha's explained in the Diamond Sutra. O Subhuti, when I attained unsurpassed, complete awakening, I attained nothing whatsoever. And there was no one to attain it. This is trying to say what I'm trying to say, and I may be fumbling in my words about this, but when you understand that there is nothing to be attained, just as I was explaining last night, there is no way of being secure, of stopping the process of change and transformation, which we call life and death. There is no way of separating yourself from the whole field of universal process. So as you understand that there is nothing to be attained, and that's the whole point of this thing, then you see as a kind of your mind as a flip. That flip is called Satori. You see that everything is it. And therefore, you can, within that understanding, live your everyday life. You are, as it were, set free to forget about religion and concentrate on anything you want to concentrate on. But the curious thing is that in the moment when you see there's nothing to get and nothing to attain, and there's no special state of consciousness your mind ought to be in, the moment you see that, there is something, in a way, added to you. It is different. It's not the same as you were in before, and also it's not another. That's the hard thing to explain. One can use analogies and say that it's like you became aware that the moon is three-dimensional instead of a flat plate in the sky. You see what you always saw, but you suddenly understand that it's three-dimensional. Well, so in the same way, more or less the same way, you see all that you ordinarily see, but you see the new dimension in it, you see that it's all you. And that nothing, not even the unconsciousness or death, makes the slightest difference to that. In fact, death becomes an extremely important way of understanding this. Think about death. Imagine the end of consciousness. Imagine going to sleep and never, never waking up again. Consider that, you see, carefully. Well, you very soon, after thinking about going to sleep and waking up, never waking up, it occurs to you that when you were born, you woke up without ever having gone to sleep. And you realize then that the state after death and the state before birth are the same state. They are the off period that polarizes with the on period, when you know something is happening, when there is knowledge, when there is feeling, when there is vibration. Well, obviously, if there is going to be, if we're going to realize that there is something called is, we can only do so in contrast with the is not. And so let go, don't resist this thing. You don't need to ensure that you will survive death. Just let it happen. Because life death is the pulsing of the energy which you are. You really want to die, that's why you die. That's the truth in Freud's idea of a death wish. You want to go to sleep. You may try to resist it with as part of yourself, but basically you want to go to sleep. And you want, in the most deep sense, in the sense of karma, you want everything that happens to you. Because it's all your situation and your scene. So, in coming to understand this, you might say to me, well, you've made a lot of statements about this kind of consciousness, but I really don't see that they mean anything because it doesn't really make any difference. Anybody who analyzes this sort of thing logically, anybody who takes a logical approach to mysticism, will come to the conclusion that the mystics are talking a lot of nonsense. Because what difference does it make? Now, it's perfectly true that this is not exactly logical. If I say all things are the manifestations of a single energy, they would say all you're really doing is you're making a statement about all things. And you can't make a statement about all things. Because any one thing that is true of all things will be meaningless. It's like adding a number, the same number or the same letter, to both sides of an equation. It makes no difference. If I say everything in the world is moving slightly up, you will ask, up with respect to what? And since there isn't anything else but everything, I can't locate that relative point in respect to which everything is moving up. So they would say in the same way, if I say everything is divine or everything is a manifestation of the Tao, they would say, well, you've said it about everything, and therefore you've said it about nothing. Well, I can't help it. That may be true from a logical point of view, but nevertheless, when you experience this to be so, it makes a great deal of difference. It's a shattering experience that absolutely, sometimes it makes the sweat pour out of you. It's so startling. And can make you jump for joy. Absolute, total delight. And so I have difficulty in explaining that logically. But that's what you see. You see, as we say in our weak words, it's all one. It doesn't make any difference. And what this does, it has a very, very marked psychological effect, because it immediately cuts down the resistances you put up all the time. And it frees your psychic energy to do all sorts of things that you don't normally have energy for at all. Because you waste it in fighting your experience. The thinker fighting his thoughts. The thinker is the thoughts. Who's going to fight it? Show me you. That's always the question of the Zen teacher. You say you have problems. You say you confront a world which is threatening to you. Show me you. Bring me out the separate you that has these experiences. And of course, the more you look for the separate you, you can't find it. You go on round and around and around trying to say, who is myself? Where do I start all this? You see, you can't find it. Of course you can't, because there is no separate you. The quality, you see, you say, you look at something else, someone else. But you see the color of the other person's face, the color of another person's eyes when you look at them. That is the same as you. There would be no such things as eyes and no such thing as color, except in terms of you. So wherever you look, you are looking at the real you. There is no observer separate from the color of somebody else's eyes. Do you see that? All these, you see, we can, from a scientific point of view, dissect brains and say, well, there is this nervous system, and there is that nervous system, and there's the other nervous system. And when they get into contact with each other, they reflect each other like mirrors, you see. But the guy who's saying this and analyzing it all out is in a certain relationship himself with all these separate brains he's looking at and plotting out. And he can never unstick that relationship. That's, as scientists know today, they talk about the myth of the independent observer. There is no such thing, because every time you make an observation, you interfere with what you're observing by making the observation. You can't unstick yourself. You can't disentangle yourself from the total web that is this universe. and say to stand aside from it and observe it as if you were an outsider is ridiculous. And the reason why is it's you. All study of nature is simply self-observation. Only it's you in a much greater sense than we ordinarily give to this word. We ordinarily give to the word I the sense of something that is an independent observer. But the I, which is actually operative, is in no way different from what it's looking at. The I-ness of you, you see, if I look around at you, and I want to find myself as you and in you, well, you have dark hair, you have blonde hair. And in the blonde color and in the dark color, that's me. In other words, we are in a situation where we are mutually vitalizing each other. It isn't that I'm in this body the only one that's real, but we are all, shall we say, tits on one sow. We are all rays from one center and mutually calling each other into being, like the back and the front, the mutual aspects of the coin or the sheet of paper. And in this relationship, of course, everyone is necessary. Everyone is an essential part of the whole goings-on. Even if your bodily appearance is only very brief, that brief bodily appearance is an essential part of the eternal universe. And the eternal universe could not exist without it. So just as a big weight can hang on a thin rope, so eternity can hang on a tiny short time. So, now, this is very important to understand in a time when an enormous number of people are interested in the mystical experience and are using every conceivable means to try to get there. Although I don't deny the value of all yogas and all specific ways of approach, whether they be the meditation exercises in the old-fashioned way or whether they be the use of psychedelic chemicals, these all have their value. But, you finally have to understand that this state of consciousness is not something to be attained because you have it. You're always there. Only you need some sort of a jolt to see that. And so often it is the meditation exercise or the upaya. We call these various means. The upaya means a stratagem, a device, a gimmick. And there are these various means to jolt us into understanding that we were there all the time. That it isn't anything special. There's a phrase that's used in Zen of this kind of consciousness called in Chinese wuxia or in Japanese buji. You can probably remember buji more easily than wuxia. But it means nothing special. It also means no fuss. It can mean no business, a sense of busyness. And a person who is, shall we say, perfectly religious is wuxia. That means he doesn't look as if he's religious. He fits into the landscape. Not compulsively. I mean, it's not like the kind of person who is self-effacing out of timidity. When necessary, the person who is in the state of Satori can come on very strong or suddenly vanish and leave no trace at all. It isn't that you feel a compulsion to be modest It's rather that you feel the incredible richness of the world as you are experiencing it now. Because that's the point. Let me try and put it in some other ways, because perhaps through talking about it from different points of view, I strike a bell of recognition in someone. It's often said that one of the great ways of yoga, and this is particularly applicable to the everyday yogas, the yoga of cooking, the yoga of accounting, or whatever it may be, that you concentrate in the present. Some of you who've read the writings of Gurdjieff and Uspensky have read about the self-remembering exercise, where you are vividly aware of everything you do all the time, that it is happening now. You live in present time. That's one of these exercises. It's a very interesting exercise. Always be alert. Are you here and now, or are you wandering? Are your thoughts off somewhere else, you see? Are you completely with what you're doing? Because naturally, when one is engaged in something very important, like a surgical operation, you have to be completely with it. Now, do you do everything that way? Do you eat your breakfast that way? Do you make love that way? See, are you absolutely with it? So this meditation exercise is practice in being completely with it. Now, the funny thing is that the end of this exercise is the discovery that you can't be in any other state of consciousness than that one. Because everything you're conscious of in any way is the present. The memory of the past is the present. It's like an echo of something that happened a few seconds ago. The echo goes on. And the echo is here. And the echo is the memory of the noise. And your brain is full of echoes. But they're all present. There is no way of being anywhere else than the here and now. But that's what you find and discover through trying to get into it. You have to try to get into the eternal now to realize that there's nowhere else to be. And you do that, you see, by analyzing, by carefully watching what you're doing, and you discover that your memories and your distractions, your thoughts about the future, your thoughts about the past, they're all happening now. I am thinking about the past. I am anticipating the future. And that then, if that's what I'm doing, then really do it, you see, get with it. Get with thinking about the future. Get with thinking about the past, and you'll find it's all present. Now then, this is a marvelous feeling when you catch this. You feel that the present moment is like a great stream that's carrying you along. See, how can you get out of the present moment? Just try. Can you avoid it? Can you be somewhere else? No. Well, if you see the present moment as the same thing as Satori, you see what I mean? This the present moment, this now that is somehow always still and yet always moving, that is the Tao. That's God. That's eternal now, eternal life. And you can't get away from it. Just try. Pull against it, push against it, shove against it, try and assert yourself against it. There's no way of doing it. And therefore, I can use this image, this symbol of the present moment, as a way of illustrating what this kind of consciousness is like. Other people might use the symbol of space. That's often used when the Chinese word for shunyata, Sanskrit term for the great void, which is the ultimate reality, they use the word that originally meant sky or space, gu. Just as you can't get out of the present moment, you realize you're everywhere in all directions you're contained by space. And space, what is space? Space is your own mind. Everything that you are aware of occurs in space. And so, let's first of all relate space to the eyes. Space are those areas of the retina not being stimulated by something. And therefore it constitutes the background for every visible form. Space is the groundwork of optics. Let's consider it from the standpoint, let's consider space from the standpoint of hearing. It's the silence in your ears against which you hear sounds and can distinguish them. Let's consider space from the sense of touch. It's where you move your hands in the dark and meet no obstruction. And you have a kinesthetic sense of space in that way. But space is fundamentally the englobing background to all specific sensations. So there's visual space, auditory space, tactile space. Probably there's olfactory space, but as I said, that's a sense for which we don't have many words. Smellessness, against which you distinguish particular smells. But that space is the way in which we experience the availability of our consciousness for particular sensations. It is the room in consciousness for this and for that. So everything that you experience as space, vast, vast outgoing space to the limits of the universe, that's simply you, that's your mind. And just as every point in the universe, because it's a curved space-time continuum, may be regarded as the center of the universe, so every living being may be regarded as the center of the universe, the center of space, which is, as it were, multi-centered. It's easy to think about that mathematically, but difficult to think about it in sort of ordinary three-dimensional terms. So then, you may form the impression that I'm saying, just as I can't get out of the present moment, and I'm always moving with it, that therefore the Tao is something to which I am related in a deterministic way. My ego then becomes nothing more than a puppet which is pushed around by the great energy of nature, and all I do is sort of dangle on the end of it and ride along, again like the leaf on the wind. So let me remind you that that image of the leaf on the wind or of the person floating in the stream is only analogy, that what I'm trying to say is that the leaf is the wind. There is nothing in this universe which is being moved by something else called the cosmic energy or God. All these things that appear to be being moved by it are it. It's just like you have to have difficulty in understanding that a pattern can exist without being made of some substance. That the pattern is the same thing as the substance. When you, for example, touch anything solid, you say, well, I feel that I am touching something substantial. But what is happening, what that feeling is a pattern. The sense that you call hard is, just say for the argument, it's jig, 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 jig in consciousness, as distinct from jig, 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 which would be what we call soft. All sensation whatsoever is pattern, different kinds of pattern. And therefore, there is no substance involved in this. The pattern isn't made of something as we would think that a pattern of wire had to be made of metal. Because when we analyze metal, and what we mean by metal, it's a pattern. Only it's on a smaller scale than what we call wire. There's nothing else but pattern. Now, there's a certain difficulty to our common sense in seeing that. We say, you can't have a pattern unless it's made of something. So in this exactly the same way, there is not the universal energy as something distinct from, some stuff behind, out of which mantelpieces and people and birds and trees are shaped. Like we make so many carvings out of wood. It isn't like that. It is that these shapes are the energy. There's no duality at all. So you, when you feel this, you will, as I said a little while ago, at first feel passive, because you're not used to it. And the initial impression is one of passivity. But the thing you actually get onto is there's no difference between the energy and you, or between what happens and what makes it happen. It's all one. Things are not forced to happen unless you insist on abstracting the thing away from the totality. When you do that, you say, what makes the thing behave the way it does? Well, you've answered your own question, because you asked the wrong question in the beginning. You started by falsely separating it from what goes on, and then forget you've done that, and then say, well, what makes it behave the way it does? You created the problem by making the separation. As soon as you divide the universe into a lot of separate things and think about them that way, then you have the problem. How do they fit together? Or it was you who took them apart. So the answer to how do things fit together is simply the counter question, how did you take them apart? Why did you analyze the universe into a lot of separate behaviors? Well, it became convenient to do that in order to talk about them. That's calculus. Calculus analyzes curves into point instants. The curves don't come that way, but you think about them that way. And if you forget that that is the technique of thought, the methodology of thought, then you create all kinds of false problems. How did, what is the meaning of life? How did this universe come into existence, etc., etc., etc.? The answer is it didn't come into existence sometime off in the past. It only came into existence now. This is the point when the universe comes into existence. And what we call the past is its wake, its echo, reverberation, like the wake of the ship. The wake starts from the nose, the bow of the ship. That's where the wake is created. So in the same way, this whole cosmos is created from this point called here and now. This is the point of the Big Bang. Everybody's looking backwards to try and find out when it started. You don't look backwards to find out. You look in here to find out. See, it's you who's starting it now. It's all flowing out from your consciousness. Only because you don't know that and you've forgotten it, you're looking back behind you and saying, wonder how I got involved in all this. Maybe it was my father and mother, and maybe their father and mother. And go back, you pass the buck and the blame for everything all along down the line. See? Ha-ha! You're looking in the wrong direction. So you're starting it now. Generating all this. The past is just echoes of what you did before. After all, you were your father and mother. Their fathers and mothers and so on all the way back. Same old you. Like, you know, when they, when you're my father, still alive, he says his name's I, and he feels central just the same way I feel central. He feels he's all the world going on around him. He feels just like just the way I feel. Well, it's the same fellow, you see, only doubling up, looking at everything from all sorts of different points of view. And so long as you feel that way, you are the here and now. You are the point from which creation begins. Beautiful. Well, we're going to stop now and have an intermission.